Good morning. On today's programme, managing the largest religious festival on earth and the return of the controversial business of mink farming to Denmark. But first we go to Syria, on the outskirts of Damascus, a detention centre known as the Palestinian Branch, once held thousands of prisoners. Run by the military intelligence of Bashar al-Assad, it was notorious for the systemic torture carried out by the former Syrian regime against its own people and those it perceived as opponents. Now under the control of the rebel force, which is part of a new caretaker government in Syria, the prison has been revisited by former detainees trying to process the cruel and inhumane treatment they suffered there. Hannah McCarthy visited the Palestinian branch and sent this report.
The sound of rush hour traffic passes over the walls of the prison on the outskirts of Damascus. Once run by the military intelligence of Bashar al-Assad, rebel fighters overran the detention centre, known as the Palestinian Branch, last December. Military fatigues, hastily removed by fleeing soldiers, still litter the exits of the Syrian prison complex. The jail now lies empty except for the rebel forces overseeing it. Mohammed Abu Ibrahim, a young rebel fighter, has been assigned to accompany myself and two Syrian journalists around the prison. After a walk through one of the entrances of the hulking grey building, I hear a loud bang that rings out across the outside yard. Some grenade shell casings are still scattered across the grounds, and there's a risk that an unexploded ordnance might have gone off. But instead, Mohammed explains that he was just getting rid of a bullet stuck in his gun. All suddenly much more alert after Mohammed's shot, we walk under a mutilated poster of Assad and inside the walls of a building that only weeks before held thousands of prisoners. In dark and empty cells, I try to visualise the number of people who were once held here. In one windowless cell, no more than 5 metres wide and 10 metres long, around 100 men were detained in squalid conditions. The prisoner in charge of the cell, known as the Shawish, would assign each prisoner a certain number of floor tiles, which they were required to remain on. The prisoners would then take it in turns to stand or squat for a few hours in order to get some rest. A medical doctor detained at the Palestinian branch told the NGO Human Rights Watch that prisoners' calves would often begin to swell like elephants, and after a while their legs would start to rot and decay. Originally established to monitor Palestinian groups operating in Syria by Bashar al-Assad's father, Hefez, the Palestinian branch earned a notorious reputation for torture. During the decades of the Assad family dictatorship, prison staff devised dozens of torture techniques, like the German chair, which often left prisoners with permanently damaged spines, and the flying carpet, which involved prisoners being hung from the ceiling and beaten. When the Syrian revolution began in 2011, the intelligence staff of the Palestinian branch targeted residents of Damascus's southern suburbs, particularly Al-Midan, Dafshok, and the Yarmouk Palestinian refugee camp. The walls of the cells in the prison are covered with drawings by some of these residents, their names, lists of friends who had also been imprisoned. Some of the scrolls are simple messages like, "I miss you," or "Please, like God, save us." There are also calendars and marks counting the days, perhaps to help the detainees stay attached to some sort of reality. In overcrowded cells, skin infections and diarrhea among the often starving prisoners could quickly become fatal. Prisoners also described a state of mind they called fasil, where the detainee would start to lose their mind. A detainee experiencing fasil would become disorientated and start to hallucinate before stopping eating, drinking and talking with other detainees. Prisoners who witnessed cases of fasil in their cells said the afflicted detainees usually only survived a week after entering the state. On one floor of the prison were brought to a dark, windowless room about 6 metres squared that held a dozen women and children. A small child's shoe and a baby grow lie on the floor beside the thin mats used for sleeping. Small plastic bags of clothes are hung from strings on the walls. While some women were detained with their children, in other cases the sexual abuse of female inmates by prison guards, often in the corridors outside the cell, resulted in women giving birth while in prison. Lines from Seamus Heaney's The Cure of Troy come to mind in the corridors of the Palestinian branch. Human beings suffer. They torture one another. They get hurt and get hard. No poem or play or song can fully right a wrong inflicted and endured. Since being released, some of the former detainees have returned to the Palestinian branch to see the cells where they were once held, trying to process what happened. The rebels overseeing the prison, now part of Syria's official security forces, have also been paid visits by released prisoners, inquiring about joining the new caretaker government, perhaps hopeful that once in their lifetime the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up. For World Report in Damascus, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
Next, we go to India. The largest religious festival on the planet is winding down in the North Indian city of Prayagraj. The six-week-long Hindu Kumbh Mela was attended by 600 million devotees and is a marvel of Oriental religion. Artificial intelligence, satellites and drones are all used to manage the mega event, which is centred around bathing in sacred waters to wash away a lifetime of sins. But unfortunately, this year's event has been marred by two tragedies which took a heavy toll of lives. Sajida Momin has this report from India.
Come Wednesday, and the curtain falls on the largest gathering of humanity in the world. The six-week-long Hindu Mahakumbh Mela, or the Great Kumbh Festival in Prayagraj in North India, at the confluence of three rivers, the Ganges, the Yamuna, and the mythical Saraswati, kicked off on January 12th in the biting cold. Initially, it was estimated that around 400 million devotees from all parts of India and the world would gather in Prayagraj to bathe at the holy confluence known as the Sangam. For the faithful, the Kumbh Mela is irresistible because a dip in its sacred waters is believed to wash away all sins and guarantee salvation, or nirvana, by liberating them from the cycle of birth and rebirth. It is held every 3 years, but is labelled Maha, or Great, every 12 years because of the positioning of the stars, the sun and the moon, making it an even bigger draw. But all the preliminary projections about attendance have proven to be wrong. By the fifth week itself, more than 500 million pilgrims have flocked to the temporary township, the size of 7,500 football fields, built in Prayagraj city in India's Uttar Pradesh province. The organizers, who are spending $800 million on the arrangements, are naturally ecstatic about the participation. But what's truly remarkable about the record-breaking turnout is that it has surpassed the population of most countries. And by February 26, when the curtain comes down on the eye-popping carnival of religion and spiritualism, the attendance is expected to cross a whopping 600 million. And that's astounding, as the total population of Russia is only 147 million. The United States has 345 million people, and the population of the European Union is 450 million, according to the latest census figures. The festival's growing popularity is also self-evident. Its last edition in 2019 attracted around 240 million worshippers, but the numbers have more than doubled this time. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Hindu First Bharatiya Janata Party government are attaching great importance to the mega event because they believe it showcases and elevates Hindu religion to an altogether new level domestically and globally. Before jetting off to Washington for a meeting with the President of the United States, Donald Trump, Modi paid a well-publicized visit to Prayagraj, where he waded into the auspicious waters. Top ministers of the federal government, Amit Shah and Rajnath Singh, who are in charge of home and defense portfolios respectively, quickly followed in Modi's footsteps. So did another Modi ally, industrialist Gautam Adani, one of the world's richest men. A visit by Chris Martin from British rock band Coldplay has also generated a lot of hype. Many Bollywood personalities and Indian cricketers, superstars in their own right, are also making a beeline for the Kumbh Mela, adding to its glamour and making it even more appealing to the masses. India's government machinery has vast experience in conducting mega administrative exercises like the general elections and the census in the world's most populous country. An army of officials generally do a decent job overcoming many challenges. But the Kumbh Mela has clearly stretched the developing nation's resources and infrastructure to breaking point. The ongoing event has been marred by two major tragedies which have left scores of devotees dead. 30 pilgrims were killed in a pre-dawn stampede on January 29th when unmanageable crowds surged towards the Sangam. The opposition accused the government of underplaying the tragedy by releasing information about the stampede slowly and suppressing the death figures. The government's critics claim that the death toll was in hundreds, and the outcome of mismanagement of the festival. A fortnight later, on February 15th, at least 20 devotees, mainly women and children, were crushed to death at the main railway station in India's capital, New Delhi, as crowds rushed to board trains to Prayagraj. Authorities say that they were distressed but absolved themselves of any blame, claiming that some mishaps are inevitable in the biggest congregation in human history. There are also environmental challenges, particularly pollution of water resources caused by the influx. This week, India's Central Pollution Control Board informed the National Green Tribunal that the waters in Prayagraj are heavily contaminated by very high levels of human and animal excreta, making it unfit for bathing. But Yogi Adityanath, Chief Minister of Uttar Pradesh, the North Indian state hosting the Kumbh Mela, has dismissed the pollution watchdog's warning. He says that the water is safe for even drinking and accuses the enemies of Hinduism of defaming the centuries-old religious festival. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Finally, we go to Denmark. After nearly 5 years, the controversial business of mink farming is returning in that country. Farming mink was banned in Denmark during COVID, and the story about the culling of millions of the animals went worldwide. Now the industry is returning, as Tom Carstensen reports from Denmark.
After nearly 5 years, mink farming is making a comeback in Denmark. Currently, around 43,000 mink are being raised on Danish farms, and interest in reviving the industry is growing. The organization Danske Mink, meaning Danish mink, has taken steps to facilitate this process by helping farmers acquire the necessary equipment and resources. Every week, new farmers express interest. However, the return of mink farming remains highly controversial. The 2020 mass culling of mink and the subsequent shutdown of the industry was one of the biggest political and financial scandals in modern Danish history. Critics question whether the industry should be revived at all, while others argue that the compensation paid to farmers was excessive, particularly since many mink farmers were already struggling financially before the shutdown. In November of 2020, the Danish government ordered the culling of all mink in the country due to concerns about a mutated strain of COVID-19 that had been found in mink and could potentially weaken the effectiveness of vaccines. The decision affected approximately 1,400 mink farms, leading to the culling of between 15 and 17 million mink and a temporary ban on mink farming in Denmark. However, it was later revealed that the Danish government did not have the legal authority to issue such an order. This led to a massive political backlash and eventually forced the Minister for Food, Agriculture and Fisheries, Mogens Jensen, to resign. The scandal damaged public trust in the government, with many questioning whether this drastic decision was justified or an overreaction. Following the shutdown, the Danish government negotiated a 19 billion Danish kroner, that's about 2.5 billion euros, compensation package for mink farmers and related businesses. This was the largest state compensation payout in Danish history. The money was intended to cover the financial losses suffered by farmers, compensate workers who lost their jobs, and help former mink breeders transition into new industries. However, the size of the compensation package sparked intense debate. Many critics argue that the payout was far too generous, especially considering that the mink industry was already struggling before COVID-19. Before the pandemic, mink farming in Denmark was already in decline. Global demand for mink fur had fallen due to changing fashion trends and growing pressure from animal rights activists. Prices for mink pelts had dropped significantly, and many Danish mink farmers were close to bankruptcy even before the government shut down the industry. By 2019, the number of mink farms in Denmark had already been reduced dramatically from its peak years. Some farmers had taken out large loans to keep their businesses running, hoping for better market conditions. Because of this, many have argued that the compensation package saved many mink farmers from financial ruin rather than simply compensating them for the lost business. With a ban on mink farming lifted in 2024, the industry is trying to rebuild itself. However, many politicians, environmental groups and members of the public strongly oppose the return of mink farming in Denmark. Animal rights activists argue that mink farming is inherently cruel and outdated. The return of mink farming has also divided Danish politicians. Some, particularly those from rural and farming-friendly parties, support the industry's revival, arguing that it provides jobs and economic benefits to local communities. On the other hand, opposition parties and environmental groups want a permanent ban on mink farming. They argue that the industry is outdated, harmful to the environment, and no longer economically viable. Danish public opinion on the issue is divided. Many people were angered by the 2020 scandal and the large compensation payments, believing the government mishandled the entire situation. Others feel sympathy for mink farmers who lost their businesses overnight. However, there is a growing awareness of animal welfare issues, and many Danes do not support the return of the industry. For now, the mink industry is back, but its long-term survival is not guaranteed. For RTE World Report in Elsinore, Denmark, this is Tom Carstensen.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.